Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and our YouTube channel. I am Paul Saffo. I teach at Stanford and chair the Future Studies track at Singularity University, and I will be your moderator for today's program. Our guest today is my close friend and colleague Juan Henriquez. As a business leader, advisor, and renowned speaker, his career spans business, politics, and science. He has launched multiple research and investment companies that use transformative life science technologies to solve problems in healthcare and beyond. He has sailed around the world on the Sorcerer II Global Ocean Sampling Expedition and was the founding director of Harvard Business School's Life Science Project. He has held various governmental and business leadership positions in Mexico, and as a member of the Peace Commission there, he helped to negotiate the ceasefire in Chiapas' Zapatista rebellion. His latest book examines how, as technology enables us to take control of our genes, we will be able to alter our own species and that of many others, as we are now the primary drivers of evolutionary change. The book is called Evolving Ourselves: How Unnatural Selection and Non-Random Mutation Are Changing Our Life on Earth. It was written with Steve Gullins, and I read it some time ago. I can assure you, you're in for some very provocative insights. Juanito, the floor is yours.
So let me speak for a short period of time, and then we'll get to the questions. And I'm going to do this as a truth and a dare around one very specific concept, which is that life evolves. And we'll get to the truth, and we'll get to the dare. But first, let's just review a tiny bit about this nice gentleman. So this is one of the most extraordinary people in the world. He not only studied to be a priest, a clergyman, but he then changed his mind as he sailed around the world after writing three books on barnacles. So he knew how to observe things in great detail. He was also a true gentleman and an ethical person, because when Charles Darwin received a letter from Henry Russell Wallace outlining what was a virtual copy of his theory of evolution, which he had never listened to, he was willing to give Wallace the credit for it. And that's why the first theory of evolution was announced at a gathering like this one. It had 35 people in the audience. They were running a eulogy for one of the Linnaean Society members, but they changed the program, and most of the people in the audience had no idea. They had just witnessed history. So what did Charles Darwin argue? Well, Charles Darwin argued that life evolves, and this is the first sheet in history where he shows that. So it starts with a fragment of a sentence. It says, "I think," and then he draws a tree of life down below. And he's basically saying things evolve. So this species then speciates into this and branches into that. And this is the first view of evolution that anybody saw other than Henry Russell Wallace. How does life evolve? Well, life evolves according to natural selection. So what lives and dies on this planet basically gets chosen by a whole series of natural factors. You're part of the food chain, the climate, the predators, disease. So finches in the Galapagos, Darwin's iconic finches, have different sized beaks, even though it's a very narrow geography, even though these islands are tightly packed, because the bigger beaks allow you to have the old seeds that nobody wanted to eat until there was a drought. And then the old big beaks became really useful. The smaller beaks allowed you to be more nimble, allowed you to get to these flowers or the seeds earlier. So there's all kinds of different adaptations to the same place. And when you wander into a jungle, then there are thousands and thousands and thousands of species. So there's all these micro niches and all these little things, and that's why whenever all these expeditions go out, they keep finding new species of insects or new species of plants or new species of bacteria. If you don't believe that nature can be tough, then you haven't been watching this television program, Naked and Afraid. So what happens to human beings under natural selection? Well, what they do in this program is they take a tough couple that supposedly knows how to live, you know, off of their wits. They take away all their clothes and they dump them into the Peruvian jungle, or they dump them into the South American jungle of Brazil, or they put them someplace in Costa Rica, and then they follow them for 30 days. And it's very different when you don't have a nice Patagonia jacket, when you don't have shoes, when you don't have insect repellent, when you don't have food. So if you really want to understand natural selection, then put a human being back into that food chain without any of the unnatural advantages that we have. One of the things that used to happen is we used to get naturally selected all the time. So a rose bush could kill you. A scrape could kill you. So pre-antibiotics, what often happened is the cut would become infected, the thorn would become infected, your leg would swell up like this, and eventually they'd either amputate it, which led to almost certain death, or they wouldn't amputate it, which led to certain death. So the rate of mortality for operations like cesareans was above 90% because of infections, and usually the baby also died. The second mechanism with which evolution takes place is random mutation. So what is a random mutation? A random mutation is genes play casino. So random mutation means there's no rhyme or reason to why this gene changes in this random way at different points. And that's why a cat can end up with 23 toes. Not because 23 toes is a particularly good design, but because there's a random mutation. Now, if it turns out that 23 toes are better than 24, then likely as not, this cat will have kittens that have kittens that have kittens that have kittens, and 23 toes will become the standard because that random mutation will create an advantage, not because that random mutation was in any way designed. Human beings can suffer the same thing. So every once in a while you get human beings with six fingers, and usually it's not pretty. But sometimes if you take an x-ray of a human being with six fingers, it actually looks pretty normal. And you can see how a random mutation giving you six fingers could be useful if it were designed in something that looks like this. In fact, this is Antonio Alfonseca, otherwise known as the octopus, who had 12 fingers and 12 toes. And by the way, he was the relief pitcher of the year in 2000. Because you can see how a random mutation of six fingers would allow him to pitch in ways that other pitchers couldn't match. So random mutations can sometimes be useful and survive and be passed on. What are the things that drive evolution? Well, the things that drive evolution, if you have a change in predators, if a new predator enters or if an old effective predator leaves, then you can change evolution. If you change the food system, if you change the kinds of diseases that attack something, we're seeing that now with bees and bats. If you change the environment, if you change population, if something becomes domesticated, if you change the amount of labor. So there's a whole series of factors that can lead to rapid evolution and can generate a whole series of different tortoises on the Galapagos, or a whole series of different animals in different places, or plants. So the question that you might want to ask yourself is, do you suppose any of these factors have changed over the past century? For bacteria, for plants, for animals, or for human beings? Have we changed what we eat? Have we changed the kinds of disease we die of? Have we changed the kind of work? Have we changed our environment? Have we changed our chemicals? Because if your answer is yes to any one of those, that would generate a very rapid evolutionary pressure. If you change all of them, then you would expect to see an extreme evolutionary pressure taking place. So let's try a thought experiment. Let's take and somehow revive Charles Darwin. So we revive Charles Darwin, and we dump him right here in the middle of Trafalgar Square. And he starts looking around. He pulls out his notebook because he was a great observationalist. And first he takes note of the buildings, and he says, you know, those buildings all look really similar to when I was around. In fact, they're the same buildings. And then he starts taking note of the human beings walking by. And what would he note that is different between, call it the 1840s and the 1850s, when he and Charles Dickens were wandering around London, and today? Well, the first thing he'd note is people have gotten really big. So there's about 1.5 billion obese people, and you probably noticed that on your last cross-country trip with your neighbor. And as you're looking at this stuff, the index of obesity in Mexico now exceeds the index of malnutrition. It's not just the U.S., it's not just Europe, it's happening all over the place, but a more curious thing is happening, and that is our pets are getting obese. So the amount of insurance claims coming from pets, the number one cause of an insurance claim is things related to obesity, just like humans that are suffering from diabetes. And the weird thing is, it's not just house pets that are getting obese. It turns out at least 12 different species of wild animals are getting obese. So why are lab rats getting obese? Right? As a scientist, one of the things that you don't want to do is you don't want to change the variables. So you really don't want lab rats to be different today than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And why are wild grass-fed horses getting obese? And part of the answer to this may be that on farms, one of the things that has been used for a while is very small doses of antibiotics, not to cure the diseases of the animals, but to promote growth. So it turns out that animals that have a small amount of antibiotic in their feed gain weight a lot faster. And because 80% of the antibiotics we produce aren't being used to cure human diseases, they're being used on things like farms, and some of those things leach into the environment, we may be putting out a series of compounds that are causing obesity, and it may not just be fast food and soft drinks. Second thing we've done is we've created a whole class of chemicals, some of which are in certain types of plastic, that we call obesogens. And these are things that when they get into your body, they generate fat instead of muscle. So as we begin to change the environment, we begin to change the morphology of bodies. The second thing that Darwin would notice is this species has gotten really weak. So just think about what it was like in Dickens' time, right? So you've all read Dickens in A Tale of Two Cities. And there were laws being passed during this period that said, we are a civilized society and therefore no child will be allowed to work in a coal mine before age 8. Right? So most people during this period of time did hard physical labor, and they were doing it in nasty factories, or they were doing it hauling water, or they were doing it on the farm, or they were doing it here or there, but these were strong people if they survived. So we who work in offices and work on computers are on the whole a much weaker species. The next thing you'd notice is this is a much older species. We've doubled the lifespan in the last century. So he would notice that there's far fewer kids and far many more older people sitting, walking around. And by the way, for some reason, they don't seem to have a lot of wrinkles. And they seem to have all their teeth. And they seem to be running half marathons. So remember, when Social Security was put into place in the 1960s, your average expected lifespan was 2 years after 65. Very, very different and very rapid evolution and stuff. So if you tabulate all these changes, these are really, really big changes just in 100 to 150 years in what humans look like. And that might lead to a question like, is this a new species? And there might be some evidence that perhaps it is. By the way, watching back there is this wonderful new species. This is my co-author's granddaughter. The other question they'd ask is it rapidly mutating? And, of course, there's some evidence of rapid mutation. And as you're looking at this, that would lead to an interesting question, which is, would Darwin write the same books? And I think the answer is he'd write about two-thirds exactly the same. But he might write the last third in a different way. And what might he write? Not because he was wrong, but because we've so changed the rules of evolution that he would have to reconsider some of the things that he wrote about how it happens. Let me be a little bit more explicit. It's not just the morphology of the human body that's changing, so too are the basic drivers of evolution. And what does that look like? So for 4 billion years, what lived and died on this planet depended on two things. It depended on natural selection, and it depended on random mutation. And these things reinforced each other, and some species came up, and some species went extinct. Now what's happened is the world's been turned upside down. So for at least half the surface of the planet, we're practicing unnatural selection, and we're practicing non-random mutation. So what does that mean? Well, what does unnatural selection look like? Unnatural selection looks like a cattle drive. These are not animals that would survive or live on the plain in a normal structure. It is not normal for horses to be in the Americas. They went extinct a long time ago. It is not normal for all the plants to be gone because these things in herds come through and eat everything and trample everything. Want to find something that is completely unnatural? Walk into a beautiful cornfield. Right? Plants do not grow in rows. The same plant does not grow because then it gets eaten by all the other insects. When you saw that picture of the jungle or the Amazon, there was a lot of diversity there, so there were a lot of targets, not a concentrated target. All natural corn. All natural corn is the size of your thumbnail, it's called teosintle. It's multicolored, and the grains fall off easily. It looks nothing like this plant that we have created. So when you go into a soy field, when you go into a wheat field, when you go into an almond farm, when you go into these wonderful artichokes on the way to Monterey, all of that is unnatural selection. A rural landscape is mostly unnaturally selected. So we mold our natural parks because we like this over here, and we cut the trees over here, and we put a road over here, and we put a little vista over here, and we take out most of the grizzly bears because they bother little kids. We take out most of the wolves because we didn't like the wolves. Right? This is all practicing unnatural selection. And if you want very specific examples of this, then you can look at something like mustard weed. So mustard weed, you know, nice little wildflower. And what happens with mustard weed if you suppress the flowers? Well, then you get broccoli. So that's where broccoli comes from. And if you suppress the bigger and get bigger leaves, then you get kale. Kale is not a natural organic substance, okay? It is the product of design. And if you go out and you sterilize the mustard flowers, then you get cauliflower. So here's this little weed that we have been shifting for our purposes. And when you go into an organic market, you are not eating all natural organic food, right? And by the way, you are not buying wildflowers for your loved one because wildflowers tend to die and they tend to be small and they don't tend to smell as nice as those beautifully designed long stem roses or those wonderful lilies. And orchids don't grow in bunches in the jungle. You find them very occasionally. But you can go into your Whole Foods or your Wegmans and find, you know, dozens of orchids, and that is completely unnatural. Unnatural selection can operate very quickly. So this is a wonderful Russian scientist who was exiled by Stalin to Siberia. He has no lab. He has no place to experiment. So what he does is he starts talking to the fur trappers, and he asks them to bring him only the 10% of foxes that are most tame. And he only breeds the tame foxes. So what ends up happening with foxes? In the course of a very short period of time, those foxes are being exported to the United States as perfect pets for children. Right? So you domesticate an animal and you do it in a very few generations. And oh, by the way, you also change the morphology of these animals. So this animal gets blonder. The ears start to flop. It loses its pungent smell. So it's not just the character, it's the body that changes as you domesticate the animal. So what's been happening to humans as we have moved in one century from being a mostly rural species to being a mostly urban species in ever greater concentrations because the apartment costs in San Francisco and Hong Kong have gotten so high? So we have to have taller buildings, we have to have smaller apartments, we have to crowd ourselves and much more. And this is a situation where the acceleration of this stuff is happening at a mind-boggling rate. Just one order of magnitude. China used 150 5% more cement in 3 years than the U.S. did in one century. And China's going to build 30 cities over the next decade or two that are going to be 30 of the largest cities on the planet. So you're taking a population that is mostly rural, and you're urbanizing it, and you're urbanizing it really quickly. So as you're thinking about this, we have to domesticate our pets. Right? You have to have these pets used to living in small apartments. You have to walk them, and you have to have pets that get along with species they normally don't get along with. And, oh, by the way, just as we've been domesticating our pets, we've been domesticating human beings. And that has been something that's been going on for the past few centuries. So let me give you a sense of what you're looking at in this chart. On top is what happens to human beings if there is no government. I'm not talking good government. I'm not talking, you know, a government that really works. I'm talking any government. So for a huge portion of human history, when there weren't governments, no dictators, no nasty people, no kings, etc., what ended up happening is a whole lot of people got murdered. So one of the most common things that you can find is you find male skulls with holes in the same part of their head. Why in the same part of their head? Because most people are right-handed, and that's how they hold the rock and hit the other person. So what you're looking at in this thing is, in non-state societies above, what are your chances of being murdered? Now, what you're looking at below the line, that first line, those are those, you know, horrible, bloodthirsty, human-sacrificing Aztecs. So even the Aztecs, who used to bathe the pyramids and cut out people's hearts while they were still beating everything else, they are a whole lot less likely to murder a people than non-state societies. And then by the time you get to France in the 1700s, and then you get to France in the 1900s, and that little tiny, tiny line at the bottom you can barely see, that's the world today. So despite Afghanistan, despite Yemen, despite all the stuff that we're reading about, despite the evening news, your chances of being murdered today are just minute compared to most of history because we've domesticated humans. What does human domestication look like? Well, just go into a museum. Go take a look at the paintings of the 1500s, and what used to be the spectacle, either by the church or the government on Saturdays, used to be, let's burn a whole series of people in the main square. And oh, by the way, as we're burning them, or before we burn them, let's whip them. And let's pull apart their limbs. And let's make it hurt. And let's do it for a long period of time. Right? That used to be the entertainment. So all these paintings that you see are paintings of some pretty nasty stuff happening. Here's what happened in New England from 1650 to 1800. So if you were a white European New Englander, this does not apply to Hispanics, does not apply to African Americans, but if you were a white European New Englander, your chances of being murdered in 1800 are 1/8 of what they were in 1650. Very fast drop in violence. Very rapid increase in domestication. It took us a long time after that to begin to treat all people alike. So you would still see scenes of escaped slaves being hung in main squares for days until they died in positions like this. We continue to treat human beings in extraordinarily nasty ways, and then we put their heads on pikes. And we did that through the 1650s, and we did it after the 1650s, and there are still lynchings going on even today. But the number of lynchings, the acceptability of this behavior, which used to be tolerated by everybody, which used to be the entertainment in the main square, is now considered absolutely barbaric behavior, not just in the OECD, but in any country on the planet. A domesticated human society does not tolerate that behavior. And so the index of crime in country after country after country has just continued to drop. You're looking at the OECD curves right here, and they're just going through the floor. And if you want a visual on this, think about what it was like walking through 42nd Street and Times Square in the 1980s, or walking through the combat zone in Boston, or walking through parts of San Francisco in the 1980s, and what it's like today. Times Square has been Disneyfied, the combat zone in Boston has become a theater district, and area after area in San Francisco becomes a place where you don't really worry as you walk at night. The other thing we've been doing is generating wealth on an absolutely extraordinary scale. So for most of human history, what we did is we were hunter-gatherers. And now what we've done is we've gone out and just generated an absolutely extraordinary amount of calories, extraordinary amount of healthcare, extraordinary amount of education. Now, it's not all equally distributed, not everybody has access to, but every single one of the Millennium Goals that were established in 1990 were met and exceeded on a global basis. So as you go through this stuff, that nature, that daunting natural selector of people has become this little playground that we call nature. So we go out and we put on our little jackets and we put on our hiking boots and we say, kiddies, go out and play in nature. You didn't used to do that, okay? As soon as you went beyond the walls of your little town, there were grizzly bears out there. There were nasty people out there. There were diseases that killed you out there. If you didn't have to travel, you didn't do so. Right? That's why Marco Polo was so damn famous, because he went out and did stuff that most people didn't do, because going to play in nature was a deadly thing to do. And today it's entertainment. Again, if you want a visual and numbers on this, your chances of dying globally in an extreme weather event have been collapsing decade after decade after decade. Not because there are fewer hurricanes, not because there are fewer tornadoes, but because we've better prepared for this stuff. We build the buildings in a different code. We tell people there's a hurricane coming. We tell people to shelter. We structure these things so that we prepare for it, and your chances of dying in the stuff have dropped through the floor. So that's the unnatural selection part. And by the way, unnatural selection has been really good for human beings because we've doubled our lifespan in about one century. Right? We are far more comfortable. We have far more food. We have an excess of food. Far less likely to be murdered. The unnatural is not always bad. Then you get non-random mutations. What does non-random mutation look like? Non-random mutation is something discovered by Berg, Boyer, and Cohen, which sounds like a law firm. But it's not. It's these three nice people right here, some of whom worked very close to here. And what they discovered is these are genes. You can separate genes. You can cut genes, and you can paste them over here. So you can do with genes what we now do with word processors. So we can take them from here, we can move them over here for specific purposes. I would like to make a beer that tastes better. I would like to make cheese that tastes better. By the way, cheese, organic cheese. How often do you go into the forest and find cheese? Right? I mean, biotechnology is something that is completely unnatural that we've been doing for thousands of years. But we started doing it in earnest in the 1970s with these three characters who began introducing non-random mutations. And when you introduce a non-random mutation and change a biological system from random mutation to non-random, then, to pick a completely non-controversial phrase, you might be practicing intelligent design. Just to pick a random phrase. What does intelligent design look like? Intelligent design looks like this little cell right here. So this is a cell that we created in a company that we founded about, 8 or 9 years ago now. And the idea, after a few drinks in a Virginia bar, Landini's, was could we create the equivalent of a computer chip that would be a cell as opposed to a computer chip? So a computer chip executes code in ones and zeros. And as long as you put it in ones and zeros, it'll run your photographs, it'll run your music, it'll run your spreadsheets, it'll send out love letters, it'll do accounting, it'll do whatever you want, as long as it's in ones and zeros. Wouldn't it be interesting if you could program a cell to do the same thing as long as it's in the language of DNA and ATCGs? And I know you're all just as excited as I am by that photograph. But it took us about 4 years and $40 million to take that photograph. Now, it does help when one of your co-founders was the guy who sequenced the human genome, and the other guy won the Nobel for restriction enzymes, and the other guy's the lead IP lawyer in the US, and I was just along for the ride as an innocent venture capitalist. But this is a bacterially controlled cell for a chemically synthesized genome. And why is that important? Because it means that you can begin to design evolution structures that do what you want them to do. You can design cells to make fuels. You can design cells to make food for fish. You can design cells to make food for animals. You can design them to make proteins. You can design them to make a whole series of things. And now you've got technologies like CRISPR. And CRISPR does the same thing on steroids. It takes big blocks of genes and treats them like Legos. So we want to move it from here to here, and that is generating a certain amount of worry among scientists because they're saying the stuff is too darn powerful. So why do we write books like this? Because these technologies are spreading, and these are important technologies. And in the same way as you used to have internet cafes 20 or 30 years ago when computers were complicated and expensive, you're now getting biohacker cafes, and for $150, high school students and college students are beginning to bring good things to life. To pick another random sentence, which is why you have contests like iGEM, the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition, where people are beginning to design yogurts that substitute for part of your kidney function. Or they're beginning to design yogurts that turn green when they're exposed to that chemical that came out of China that was hurting people. Or they begin to design photographs that have 10 times or 20 times the resolution of the highest end digital cameras. And there was one team, the team from Tokyo, that showed up and said, you know what, I'm just going to make 4 gene changes, which is not a big deal. I'm going to take these genes out of these cells, and I'm going to make sure they don't freeze, they don't burn, they're immune to radiation, and they oxidize. Now, as a genetic engineer, that's not nearly as cool as what the Germans did, which was to try and build a television screen out of bacteria. But why was the Tokyo Project interested? Because what they wanted to do is to put these into the nose cone of a rocket and shoot it at Mars. And if you have a bacteria that doesn't freeze, doesn't burn, is immune to radiation and oxidizes, that bacteria may just build an entire atmosphere around Mars. So what they wanted to do was to terraform the planet, which is kind of cool. So here's the truth. The truth is, it's not the religious fundamentalists that are slowly killing Darwin, it's scientists. And they're not doing so because they disrespect him, they're not doing so because he wasn't right, but they're building a parallel evolutionary system that operates on different rules. And humans are beginning to directly and deliberately take control of evolution because they are determining, I do not like smallpox. Smallpox bad for human beings. Let's eliminate smallpox. Well, that's taking out one of the greatest factors of natural selection in human history. I don't like polio. I'm going to take that out. I like these kinds of plants. I don't like these kinds of plants. I like these kinds of dogs. I like these kinds of cats. I don't like these kinds of things over here. And I really like organic food. So I'm going to make a small green berry the size of your thumbnail that's poisonous a wonderful heirloom tomato. Part of evolution is now directly driven by unnatural selection and non-random mutation. And here's the dare. The dare is, this is a big change. The dare is, humans are now taking control over a big chunk of evolution. And we have to deal with the symptoms and consequences of this. First, we have to recognize it, because we can no longer blame random mutations. We can no longer blame nature. We can no longer blame the god of water or the god of the sun. It's us. And we're making these choices, and we're becoming very powerful at making these choices, so we have to figure out what we're going to do with it. And as my friend Vladimir Ilyich Lenin used to say, there are decades where nothing happened, and there are weeks where decades happen. And that is happening every week, because this lab over here has just changed 2 of the base pairs in DNA. So for 4 billion years, ATCG was a life code. And they've made ATXY. That means that you now have a life form that reproduces in a chemical form that is completely different from life on other parts of this planet. That means, in theory, you could build, a plant that would be immune to all diseases and all bacteria and a whole series of other consequences. So, if we have this power, how do we want to redesign plants? Bacteria, animals, and perhaps even ourselves. What do we want archaeologists to find in 500 years, in 1,000 years, in 10,000 years? What are we going to do with this power? And that is the first chapter of the book, Evolving Ourselves.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Juan. And just a reminder before we begin the conversation here, there are question cards available, and I already have several great questions from the audience, so please don't be shy. Scribble these up, hand them in, they'll get sent up to me, and we will go through the questions. And before I go any further, I just want to remind our radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Juan Enriquez, futurist and co-author of Evolving Ourselves, How Unnatural Selection and Non-Random Mutation Are Changing Life on Earth. I'm Paul Saffo, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on the Commonwealth Club's YouTube channel. So I got about a million questions. And I am also grateful to you right at the start. You know, I have always wondered why I detest kale chips. And now I have the perfect excuse. The next time somebody forces kale chips on me at the local farmer's market. I want to start with a question about Darwin. As you said, I believe that he would write two-thirds of the same book. And, of course, evolution is a topic that everybody understands, and we all have assumptions about what evolution is, terms. And over time, there have been those terms that have caught on, like survival of the fittest, that have been used in funny ways. You opened with that marvelous image of his original tree diagram, and I think, if Darwin was back today, seeing what's going on with biotech and post Crick and Watson, would he still draw a tree as the depiction of life? Is life a tree?
So it's fascinating to watch what's happened to maps of life. Because they did start out, when they started doing genomics, which is learning how different life forms have their DNA coded in long letters. So you put them into machines, and these long strings of A, T, A, C come out. Really boring books, but really useful. Then what ends up happening is, at first they started drawing all these trees, and they started buying all these diagrams, and first they went up, and then they had to go to the side because they got really complicated. And what we've been learning is that evolution is really promiscuous. So every day we are being recoded. And one of the ways we get recoded is somebody sneezes next to you. And when they sneeze next to you, they insert that bug into your lungs. That bug goes into your cells. It reproduces. It breaks the cell apart. And it recodes your body. And so you've got 100 times more non-human cells in your body than you have human cells. And these cells are continuously recoding your body and your structures. So what life looks like today isn't a map of a tree, it looks like this really complicated, interesting mesh.
Looks like a thicket.
Yes.
Looks like a tangle of brambles.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, and it's getting more complicated as we learn more about it.
And this is why, I mean, when I think about that, and Juan hinted at it, but we should state here, he is way deep into genetics and genetic engineering, and hangs around with the people who basically invented modern genetic engineering. Sometime when we're off mic, I'd love to know what it's like to be in the middle of the Pacific alone with Craig Venter. I cannot imagine. But
you do the only thing that's rational. You stop the boat exactly in the middle of the Pacific, you have a shot of tequila, and you dive overboard naked. Because, I mean, what cooler place could you possibly have to swim than exactly in the middle of the Pacific Ocean?
So I want to come back to this shift from the tree of life to, it seems to be it's a thicket or a web or something else, but it goes to my central question. As I read your book and I'm thinking about Darwin and, you know, this giant of an intellect with deep insight, but he reminded me of another giant, and that's Newton. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is Darwin to biology what Newton has become to physics, in the sense that when Newton wrote the Principia, everyone said all was revealed. But what we know today after the passage of time is Newtonian physics is great for helping us navigate without hitting rocks on our way from one point to another, but it actually doesn't work in terms of understanding what the universe actually is. And has Darwin become that for biology?
So, you know, they are Copernicus and Newton and Darwin and Wallace are some of the greatest people, and we've been lucky as humans to have them and to teach us this stuff. And I think we do a great disservice by disrespecting them in any way, because what they learned, how far they pushed us with the instruments they had, is just mind-boggling. But we do have new instruments, and we are discovering new things. And by the way, the same thing's about to happen to physics. I think in the next 10 years, we will figure out what dark energy is. And, you know, we only are missing 90% of the energy in the world. So you're going to have to change your whole concept of what energy is, of how energy moves, of what causes energy, and you'll have a post-Einstein revolution in the same way. That doesn't mean we have to diss Einstein or diss any of these other folks. It simply means it's good for our species to keep exploring and keep learning. And we have to respect the past, but we also have to understand how we're going to understand and build the future.
So I don't think you answered my question. I mean, is Darwin on the verge of becoming much admired for pioneering and has given us a useful tool that takes us to a level of understanding, but now we're moving beyond? And, of course, who's the next Darwin?
Well, see, it depends on how weird you want my question to be, or my answer to your question to be. So,
This is San Francisco.
It is San Francisco. Yes. So let's step off the planet for a second. We know there have been at least 5 major extinctions on this planet. We know that there's extreme cleaning. So there is perfectly possible that nature will come back one day, and she will be pissed. And she will say, thank you very much for playing, and you're out of the game. And by the way, that's happened 5 times, because it happens with asteroids or supervolcanoes.
Will and Ariel Durant put it very nicely when they said, civilization exists by geologic consent, revocable at any time.
Which leads to the Astronomer Royal of Great Britain, Martin Rees, who said, if 90% of humanity goes extinct, it's a tragedy. If 100% of humanity goes extinct, it's a completely different order of magnitude. So why does this have to do with Darwin? Because there is no system of natural evolution that gets us off this planet. Because we're not forced to adapt to a different gravity, because we're not forced to adapt to a different radiation, because we're not forced to adapt to a different atmosphere. So the only way we get humans off this planet effectively is to begin to deliberately design bodies in a non-Darwinian evolutionary terms. Right? We don't even know if you can have a baby on a different planet, because that very delicate conjunction of cells that goes from a single egg into a full child's body may be altered if you change the gravity by 10%, in which case there's no scenario under which Darwinian evolution pushes humanity in that direction and we don't survive. We're going to have to redesign human bodies if we want to get off this planet and survive somewhere else. So, you know, there's a lot of people who are scared of genetic engineering, but if you don't practice it, you pretty much guarantee humans don't survive for as long a period of time. The universe will eventually end. But we get a whole lot more life if we get off this place.
So this is becoming a branching problem for me, because each answer is leading to other things. By the way, I think we've begun to see that. I mean, our former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is proof of designing bodies to live off planet. I saw the movie. but where this takes me is an interesting thought, that one of the ideas, if we look back at the history of, you know, philosophers and religious thinking, that humanity has oscillated between 2 views of itself. There's the view of extreme exceptionalism, mm-hmm. Humankind, the crown of creation, and everything else is here to support us. And then there's the other view, which is we're just one little piece of a larger web of nature. As we enter this world of unnatural selection, where we can use CRISPR to tinker with genes, and of course we're going to have designer babies, and you and I both know it, how does that change our view of humanity? Do we go deeper into an exceptionalism phase, we're the crown of creation, or do we go the other way and we become a recognition that we're just part of a bigger web?
We better be humble in this, right? I hope that our children, our grandchildren are better than we are.
And how many times, I mean, Alfred Nobel invented dynamite in hopes that it would end all wars, and that's why we have the Nobel Prize, because he realized how wrong he was. I love your sentiment, but do you think there is a possibility that we will become more humble?
You know, I think as we become more powerful, we need to shout less. We need to demonstrate less. You know, often the people who are the nastiest and most radical and most fundamentalist are people who've been really hurt or who are really scared. Now, there are some random mutations of truly evil people, and we do have to take those people out, because occasionally you do get things and people that act in ways that just are incomprehensible in their cruelty. But most people...
Do you have any candidates? You don't have to answer that. Sorry.
God, the list just went like... it was so long. But the structure, and then what do you do with people? You know, you're asking this as a theoretical question. It's not a theoretical question. Probably this year, you will have the first human being born to three genetic parents. And it's probably going to happen in Great Britain. And the reason why you're doing that is because there's some absolutely deadly genetic diseases that lead to absolutely horrendous deaths that are caused because your mitochondria is off, and that's the battery for the cell. So what do? You take a baby and you mix the father's DNA, you mix the mother's DNA, but then what you do is you take out some mitochondria from somebody else and you insert it, and then all of a sudden you have three parents. And oh, by the way, it lasts, because your children will have three parents and their kids will have three parents, right? So this is a change that begins to engineer a human germline, and there is a perfectly reasonable and rational reason to do it. But there might also be some questions that we might want to talk about as we do these things.
Yeah, and as I was, funny, I was talking to a friend recently about this, and the question of what's happening in Kansas at the moment and a certain governor. And I said, you know, you better sort out gay marriage really fast, because let me tell you what's coming. And, you know, that the heads of certain conservatives will absolutely explode at the thought of three parents. But let me ask you, going back to the larger picture, is a question. These changes are obviously morally neutral, akin to limiting nuclear weapons. How difficult are these technologies to manage? And this is, I'll be total disclosure, I'm going to try and pin you down on the statement you were ducking earlier about when you expressed these hopes that humans would become wiser. We have a close mutual friend, Stuart Brand, who back in the first edition of the Whole Earth Catalog wrote, we have become as gods. We may as well get good at it. And recently, in a more recent book, he revised that statement to, we have become as gods. We had better get good at it. So to this person's question, I mean, are we going to get any better at managing these technologies than we have managed technologies in the past? Or is this Einstein, you know, Einstein, when he heard of the, or Churchill heard of the first atomic bomb, he said, oh, great, now the idiot children have the matches.
You know, there's always good reason to be scared, because we are becoming much more powerful. And part of what the Europeans have done with genetic technologies is they said, we're going to institute a precautionary principle that says, you can do anything you want with technology as long as you prove to me that it's not going to harm a human being. And that sounds perfectly rational, okay? Except that you would not be allowed to build a staircase, because staircases are really dangerous. You would not be allowed to have an electric plug. You would not be allowed to put salt on your food. You would not be allowed to eat a peanut anytime, right? So I think against your question, because there are dangers to this stuff, and these things can be abused, as has every technology humans have generated, the question is, what happens if you don't act? Because that's just as important a question. Do we want to take out Alzheimer's? Do we want to take out cancer? Do we want to feed a whole series of people and avoid things like blindness? Do we want to take wild Italian broccoli and perhaps put it into our own broccoli to help prevent cancer? Right? And these are questions which every generation's job is to scare their parents. So when the first in vitro baby came out, you know, oh my God, a test tube baby. And now there are millions and millions of kids, and people talk over a, you know, latte whether they're going to do it or not. And that's just become part of our lives. And I think it's really easy to scare people and spend 10% of your time being scared and understand no human generation has ever had the opportunities we have. No human generation has a better chance of living longer under better circumstances globally. So even in a John Rawls situation, you would rather be born today than at any single period in history.
And just to remind people to send in question cards. I've got some great questions I'm sort of synthesizing out here. You know, when you were talking about going into space earlier and saying we would have to re-engineer humans in order to survive in space, it reminded me that there is another evolution going on the planet, and it's a very peculiar symbiosis that you hinted at between digital, the evolution of digital devices and biological evolution that we're seeing. The obvious thing about space is to send, is to evolve our robot proxies and send them there. Mm-hmm. And the revolution you're talking about, I would argue that what Craig Venter accomplished was a case of a symbiotic intersection of rapidly evolving digital technology and more slowly evolving biological technology.
Yeah, I think that the single most interesting thing happening today is happening in departments like yours at Stanford, where you're bringing together people from very different disciplines and just colliding the stuff. And statistically what happens is when you mix departments, your productivity in terms of papers, in terms of patents, in terms of companies just goes through the roof. And as you begin to bring together the digital and the engineering and the biology, you're getting just some really interesting stuff happening. It's just a fascinating period to watch this stuff. And the people who are being very successful are mixing and matching really powerful parallel technologies, leading to that crazy meme that's going around the internet that Mars is the only planet that we know of inhabited solely by robots.
Yes. Yeah. But again, there's something deeper going on here. I mean, one has this kind of, you know, thinking about the implications of what you're writing about. There's a quiet drawing in of breath, like, whoo-hoo, wow. But particularly here in Silicon Valley, we just take it for granted how quickly technology is evolving. And there is a whole school of thought that argues that the machines are evolving very, very much faster than us and are going to leave us behind. So I guess it's nice that we can have unnatural selection and maybe we can try and keep up. But, you know, is the technology part, is the logical next chapter of unnatural selection a shift of evolution to machines?
I don't think so. I think we're going to symbiotically co-evolve with machines just as we symbiotically co-evolved with microbes. And I think in the same ways we've been domesticating microbes and now we go into the all-natural food store and take these probiotics, which of course are completely designed for our purpose. If you want all-natural microbes, go eat in a taco stand in Tijuana. Right? Probably not a good idea, but far more natural than a probiotic.
They're natural, they're just not local.
Yeah. So as you're thinking about that, I think insourcing and outsourcing machines is already to some extent rewiring our brains, because we're putting about as much data into our brains in one day as we used to put in a lifetime. and we're changing the kinds of inputs and stuff. And I think some of the experiments and some of the answer to your question is going to come from some really unlikely places. When you transplant the first mouse head, then you begin to answer some questions that have to do with a whole bunch of stuff that goes right to the core of who and what we are. Right? Because when you transplant a head, are you going to transplant memories? Is the new rat going to understand the maze? Is it going to like the same old cute rat? Is it going to remember what it was afraid of? Is it going to remember what it liked? Remember, when you transplant the first heart, you ask the question, is there any attraction to the wife of the donor? Because for thousands of years, I gave her my heart, she took my heart, she broke my heart, but it turns out to be a muscle. Now, if you transplant a head and you transplant consciousness and you transplant memory, that's a big deal. If you don't, that's a big deal too. Right? So there's some really interesting, just fundamental questions in your question. And coming back to the machines, if you do transplant a head and you do transplant all this stuff, then it's a question of input-output. And what's the interface? Because then you know it's transplantable.
And, you know, that pulls me back to the Enlightenment and the conversation earlier about is this a tree, is it a web, is humankind an exception, or are we discovering our ever deeper connections? That there's a whole community of transhumanists who recommend that you should be, you know, frozen for later recovery, and some of them argue you should only freeze the head because that's the only part that matters. One gets a little suspicious about that, but how does that change our worldview, the possibility of doing those sorts of things?
I know I'm not going to live forever. I know that nobody in this room is going to live forever. But we're all likely to live a whole lot longer than we think we're going to live, and probably with a better quality of life. Because I think we will take out many cancers in the next decade. I think the immunotherapies and the stuff coming down the pike, it's taken forever. It's been frustrating, but I think we're going to be able to really take some of this stuff out. After that, it becomes Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and a series of things. And after that, curiously, it becomes accidents. Accidents are already the fourth largest cause of death in societies like ours, not in other societies.
It's those falling safes. That's the last thing that you're going to live 400 years and get killed by a falling safe.
Yeah, or self-driving cars, or falling down a staircase, or, you know, teenagers driving. I want to get rid of some of that, okay? So as you're thinking about that stuff, what we're going to do is we're going to just increase what we think of as middle age. Now, eventually, there are going to be some really interesting questions if you can transplant stuff that have to do with, you know, do you want to clone your bladder? Well, you can already do that. Do you want to clone your trachea? Well, you can already do that. And maybe our bodies become like those old houses that are continuously being refurbished because we redo the gutters or redo the doors, but it's still the same old house, sort of.
Of course, that always makes me nervous because I think society in that kind of world will end up being divided chronologically. The very wealthy will move through time like old turtles, and the poor will live and die like mayflies.
That was poetic. Thank you.
question from the audience. What is your greatest concern regarding the ability to restructure human genes? What scares you the most about that? And let's make it two parts. What makes you most excited about that? But start with the scary part first.
The thing that scares me the most is I'm not going to be around long enough to really see how a big chunk of this movie plays out. Because we're just accelerating this stuff so fast. And I think, you know, if somehow you froze yourself or you came back in 200 years, boy, would this be a different place, right? And one very quick way of seeing that, go on YouTube and look up that internet video of what a pit stop was at the Indianapolis 500, which was 60 9 seconds, right? And that was like, and you're watching this, and you're used to watching these videos, and it's just forever. It's like, come on, guys. And they're banging away at the tires. And then right now, it's less than 3 seconds. And the contrast between those two things, right? We think things don't change, but boy, there's some brutal examples of this stuff. So what life will look like in 200 years, I think, is going to be just...
Well, you're a futurist. Offer me a forecast of when we'll watch that video and there won't be any humans in the pit stop or in the car.
Well, I know a much better futurist than I that happens to run the futurist department at Stanford. So what do you think this is going to look like in a couple hundred years?
I have another question here. as I don't want to abuse moderator's privilege. And darn it, I just lost the spot. But at what point do governments join this conversation, besides Brussels? And what regulation, if any, would you recommend when they do? And, you know, I've always thought this is an interesting thing, that the advantage that the biotech field has had is that, by definition, most politicians became politicians because they would have failed out of organic chemistry. And so they don't understand enough about this to meddle in it yet. Is that changing, and what does it start to look like?
So look, one of the reasons we wrote this book and wrote it in a way that's accessible to general audiences is because it's really important for a general audience, not just for a scientist, to understand what we're doing and what's happening and how fast it's happening, because your kids are going to be hacking with genes. And it's going to be perfectly normal, just as we wander around and use computers. And as you think about that stuff, these instruments are moving so fast into food production, into energy production, into information storage. You can store every book ever written in this glass of water if you put it into bacteria. And then you can reproduce it billions of times. And the cost of the human gene sequencing is dropping at a rate faster than Moore's Law, which means we can't build computers fast enough to store the information, to analyze the information, to triage the information. So if you think the last 30 years are fast, this stuff is coming at you, and it's coming at you really quickly. And we need to have a rational, ethical debate about this stuff. And there's a whole bunch of politicians who are arguing stuff that we settled 160 years ago. Okay, they're talking about stuff that was very clear, how old this Earth is, that things do evolve, that there are fossils, and that dinosaurs were not running around with Noah. So as you're thinking about that, I really want to focus part of the government debate on this, because this is going to determine which nations rise and fall, which diseases get cured, how we produce energy, how we store information, what our kids work in. And if we don't start educating our kids in this stuff, if we simply say, oh, I'm scared, I'm not going to do this, you're going to very rapidly change the relative place of various civilizations. Because what the digital thing did is it took a nation which was dirt poor when I was in college, and it turned into the second largest software producer in the world, which is India. The Koreans were one-fifth the income of Mexicans in 1975. They're four times the income today. Because they did learn this new language, and they used it. So they're competing on phones. They're competing on bikes. They're competing on steel. They're competing on the stuff. Because they educated their societies, and their government understood how these instruments are powerful. What would be singularly stupid for us is to take the greatest technological civilization on Earth and to say, I'm too scared to even begin to learn this language.
Again, you're not giving me any comfort. I mean, you're telling us, you know, things about how it should be, but I look back at the last century, and this is, you know, I'm not going to sleep terribly well tonight. And you mentioned Martin Rees earlier, and I witnessed his conversion from being an optimist to the second most depressed person I know, except for Ray Kurzweil. I mean, Martin is seriously, seriously pessimistic about the future of humankind. And maybe you can just sort of summarize his statement briefly. And I want to talk about that pessimism.
Oh, you know, they're wonderful, very smart people out there who are beginning to become the equivalent of French existentialists, and the world is going to end and there's no purpose. I think it's exactly the opposite. You know, I think we've got chances to actually create civilizations in many parts of the universe. And I think we're actually going to get there. And you're beginning to see the seeds of it here with SpaceX and with these groups that say, you know, these groups that are going to Mars.
I'd settle for creation of civilization in Congress, but, you know.
Well, look, there are things we can't do, okay? I mean, getting to Mars is easy.
this is interesting you say this. I mean, so what I'm hearing revealed in here is a very giddy optimism about an infinite humanity and exploring the cosmos.
You know, anytime you go and you have dinner in Iowa with people who politically may be on a completely different spectrum, who ideologically or technologically may think in very different ways than you do, you find profoundly decent human beings that you can have a conversation with. And you can have these conversations and go to Calvin College.
You're not answering my question. I mean, in your gut, is humanity headed into the cosmos?
Yes. And I think a fundamentally decent humanity is heading into the cosmos. I think these people going to Mars are like the people who got on Columbus's ships. They may make it, they may not, but these are really brave explorers. Good for them.
I know friends who would disagree about the decency of the folks on Columbus's ships, but this goes back to what evolution is, or rather, what our thoughts about evolution are. That we had ideas in the popular mind about evolution that evolutionary scientists would disagree with, and one of those ideas is that evolution has a direction. And you're shaking your head no.
A Darwinian evolution did not have a direction.
Yes.
Okay, that's why you get all these really just incredible shapes and birds and everything else. The evolution that's taking place because somebody at UCSF is designing it for this, or at Berkeley or somebody else, that has direction. That is a big change.
Yes. So we are now, I mean, a key message from your book is we are now entering an age of directed evolution.
Yep.
That dream or nightmare, depending on who it was, I mean, I forget the prelate who, right after publication of Darwin, you know, preached from the pulpit in London of the theory of evolution as proof of the existence of God. Do you remember who that was?
Bishop Wilberforce.
It was Wilberforce.
Big debate.
A very fine man. We owe him to ending the slave trade as well. So Wilberforce's dream has now become reality.
And it goes beyond that. In a strange way, Lamarck is starting to revive. Lamarck was that guy who thought, you know, evolution happens so fast that as giraffes start to reach towards the higher leaves because they're hungry, their necks will get longer and their kids' necks will get longer. And Darwin said, no, wrong, right? This takes thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of years to evolve. Well, except not so much anymore.
Right. I mean, this is quite astounding that a lot of theories that were discredited now, thanks to human artifice, are starting to come to pass. But is there something even deeper going on here? You're nodding your head, yes. I'm thinking of, I mean, we've had visionaries. Teilhard de Chardin, a paleontologist steeped in evolution, Catholic priest, and he was a committed teleologist, that he had a whole philosophical belief system that we were heading toward the omega point and that evolution absolutely had a direction. He would probably argue that it is an agent-based direction. I mean, could it be that that's the deeper story behind all this and what we see as free will of our artifices? We're just working out the teleological dreams of the universe?
So every once in a while you run across these very strange graphs, and it turns out that the amount of energy per cubic meter, erg, squared, second squared, is almost zero when you get out into the vacuum of space, and then it's some inside the sun, and then it's a whole lot more in the sun inside Earth, and then it's a whole lot more inside a plant, and then it's a whole lot more inside a car engine, and apparently the greatest single concentration of energy is inside a computer chip, because you're running about 2 or 4 billion operations in tiny bits and just concentrating electrons.
The bad news is it's still running Windows, but...
Yeah, well... There are some flaws in the universe. We do need another Hitchhiker's Guide.
I realize this sounds terribly far afield, but I think the amazing thing about these new genetic tools we have is they allow us to ask questions that would have seemed like complete fantasy. You're just talking about energy densities, and I think of the notion of the anthropic principle that, you know, humanity, it's a funny thing that the universe is structured in just a way that it allowed this kind of life to form. So it becomes a bit of a tautology. But I mean, late at night, as you're drifting off to sleep, you know, what do you think of when you ask yourself, is there something else behind the curtain, even beyond what we're discovering?
So I think the three most interesting things to work on today, how does the brain work and where does consciousness come from? Right, I mean, that is truly interesting and an important question. Where did life come from? How in the world do we go from inorganic to organic? And what are we going to do with life code?
Perfect. That was a question queued up right here.
Cool.
And let me put a really sharp point on the question.
Okay.
To me, as we're exploring the brain, and we're looking at all of this, it really raises a key question. Is humankind smart enough to understand itself?
Not yet. We're just so far. And to do what we're going to have to do, we're going to have to change our brains. Because there's no way that we can begin to absorb the complexity of stuff, right? Just take the Human Genome Project, right? We thought we had 100,000 genes. It turns out we've got 23,000, 22,000. But then on top of that, we've got this epigenome that switches the genes on and off. And on top of that, we've got the microbiome with all this other stuff. And then on top of that, we've got the virome. So when you think about how do you alter and how do you change human genes and how do you redesign them, now you've got four places where evolution comes in. You're playing chess on a four-dimensional plane with multiple variables, right? And we need to evolve ourselves to begin to deal with a universe that's a whole lot weirder than we could ever begin to imagine. I can't remember who said that, but absolutely correct.
Yes, I think there's J.B.S. Haldane. Reality is not only stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can possibly imagine.
Right.
But do you think humankind is smart enough to ultimately understand itself?
Not yet. We've had 30-some-odd variants of humans so far. Almost everybody in this room, if you have European descent, has 2-4% Neanderthal in it. And if you were in Asia, you'd have 2-4% a completely different group called Denisova. So unless if you think the purpose of all creation is to create Michael Jackson and Pam Anderson, and then it's just flat lines, and it never gets better.
Actually, I think I saw it in that movie. They're proof that aliens have visited Earth.
There you go. I think we're going to continue to evolve, and I think we're going to do so very quickly.
So I'm gonna make this the last question because I just learned we're over time. It's a practical question. It's posing as a practical question, but I think it actually is a very profound question about what this all means. And the question is, how do the constructed cells / organisms, these creatures, entities created, communicate with each other and with natural life forms? And the way I'd put that is, what does the interface look like between life created the old-fashioned way and newfangled life that comes out of these innovations.
I don't think we've got a good answer to that yet. I mean, I think it's going to be fascinating as you create alternate chemistries for heredity and to see what happens with a completely parallel evolutionary tree and do those evolutionary trees mix and what happens with that. And I think as we're doing this, I think we'd be well served to put Terminator genes into whatever we're making so that these things don't keep reproducing. Because I think these experiments are worth running, but you want to be careful with this stuff until you understand what you're doing. And I think that's just good housekeeping for doing some of this stuff. And then create these interactions under control conditions, right? You can modify where things grow. You can modify a whole bunch of parameters. But I think the experiment you're talking about is one of the most interesting experiments you could possibly run. And you can run it with machines. You can run it with alternate chemistries. You can run it with different inputs. You can run it by going across species. You can do it by redesigning existing genes. There's just so many things you can perturb to guide evolution and watch what happens. And that's going to keep our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids just happy as anything, because it's going to scare a lot of us. And it's going to seem perfectly normal to them.
And I also think, you know, in this moment where we're overwhelmed by change and this broad new horizon, there's also a deeper continuity. As you were talking, I was reminded of another New England philosopher of some time ago, Emerson, who once observed that nature is a mutable cloud. And the point of human agency seems to be making it change even faster than ever. Please join me in thanking Juan Enriquez. Juan, of course, is futurist and co-author of Evolving Ourselves, How Unnatural Selection and Non-Random Mutation Are Changing Life on Earth. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Paul Saffo. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.